Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we're flashing back to October 19th, 2011. This was originally episode 766 with Jacob Lund Fisker from Early Retirement Extreme. The way this interview happened is I found this guy's book. I think one of you actually recommended it to me, and I read it. I thought, this would be a fantastic interview. It ended up being the interview, honestly, the episode that in 16 and a half years now, I did the most post-production work on in my life. I learned that somebody being a great author and being really smart doesn't necessarily mean they'll make a great interview. In the end, though, this interview ended up being really great, and here's why. Jacob had this habit of pausing and doing a lot of ah and The interview you're about to hear was actually about 30 minutes longer when I originally recorded it, and the only thing I took out was empty space, ahs, ums, and things like that. But, right? Like, that might be a whole piece that came out. The timeline in the editing software looked insane when this was over, and yet it came out really good. Why would I even bother to tell you that? Well, I know that some of you that listen to me, you guys are podcasters yourself, okay? And this is a hard learned lesson. When you're going to bring a guest on, it's really great to have at least heard them speak somewhere else first. Anyway, in the end, this ended up being a great interview, really great interview. It allowed us to see one way to get into this state of retirement at an earlier age. You know, everybody thinks it's 65, but why do they think it's 65? Because that's when we get Social Security. Like, this is an arbitrary number that came up from the government. The reality is you can retire whenever you want to. We don't live in a slave – well, we live in a partial slave society due to income tax. But otherwise, we don't live in a slave society where somebody can make you work. The key is if you want to live your life in a way that is commensurate with what makes you happy – you need to have enough, you know, dry powder, so to say, to be able to get to the end of the game and still have enough money to live well. Jacob figured out how to do that. I don't think many people in this audience are going to follow exactly his example. It is extreme. But it is in looking at extremes that we find what works for us. We get ideas, pathways, and concepts that otherwise we wouldn't adapt to our own lives. So, with that, let us flash back to October 19, 2011, originally episode 766, Jacob Lund Fisker from Early Retirement Extreme. All right, with that, we've got the housekeeping wrapped up, and let's go ahead and get on to our main topic today. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we're fortunate to have with us Mr. Jacob Lund Fisker, author of Early Retirement Extreme, and a really cool blogger, a guy I heard about from a listener, I don't remember who, but picked his book up. Gave it a read, really liked it, mentioned him on an episode. One way or another, we got connected after that, and I asked him to come on the show, and he agreed to do so. He's a pretty interesting dude, man. He's from Denmark, and his past life, he was a theoretical physicist, and now he is a guy that's, at least in his definition of things, retired at the age of 36 and has been for a while, teaches other people how to do that, and he's here with us today to talk about these concepts. Hey, Jacob, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thank you very much.
You know,
when I read a book on retirement, I read in you know, all these different books that I've read on the subject, and most of them are about how to manage your money in a 401k account so you can retire early. I think you call that like the boomer concept of retirement. And your book's very different. It's a much more what I mean by retirement. But if we just start out with what do you mean by retirement? What is it to you?
Well, I mean, retirement is a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I get a lot, well, I get occasional comments from people who, when I talk about what I do and how I did it, they'll tell me, well, you're not retired, you still have a blog, or you still do this, or you're not doing that, so that's not retirement. And I think a lot of that is due to the specific age group or the specific generation people come out of. And my theory is that, well, that different generations have different views of retirement. If we, for instance, start with the G.I. Joe generation, those that came out of World War II, they had like a completely destroyed world, so to speak, and they wanted to work really hard to make sure that this never happened again. So they started basically from scratch building the world. And so they've been working all their life to make a better world. And at their retirement basically means that they have run out of energy. They're ready to be put out to pasture, go to a retirement home. They're sort of done working. And so they will be telling me that, well, you still have so many years left. Why are you retired? Right. For boomers, the boomer generation, that replacement, they are essentially made to manage the world that the G.I. Joe generation created. And so they have sort of put in their time, and they work for the same company for many, many years doing their thing, and then they're rewarded sort of age 60 was that then they could get to do all the things they didn't do while they were working. They didn't have the time for it. So for them, retirement is, well, got to go out and have fun, travel to all the countries you never traveled to before. You go to Disneyland, you go, you know, to the Caribbean and sail around there and so on and so forth. Now, I'm 36 now. I retired at 33. And so that pretty much puts me at the tail end of Generation X. And what we saw was we were told to work pretty hard, but there were not really that many opportunities for us in the same way. So we had to kind of, you know, shove our resumes around. We saw outsourcing, you know, we got kind of put in situations where we had to compete with each other. And at some point, I would say retirement to us is more what I don't know if this will make this podcast explicit, but retirement to us is more a question of financial independence, not having to work, and essentially the concept of what is called fuck you money, which is kind of like money you need to have in order to tell your boss that, well, fuck you, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Got you.
So that's kind of what I think of retirement. It doesn't mean that I'm out traveling. It doesn't mean that I don't have anything else to do. It just means the freedom from having to go to work every day.
Gotcha. And I kind of feel the same way. We were chatting about this before we got started today, that I think most people look at me and say, well, Jack's running a business. And I do. I run a business. I show up pretty much every day. But I don't really feel like this is work anymore. There's a lot of time that I put in, but I do some with my time anyway, and the bills are paid. So I kind of look at myself in this like nebulous world of like semi-retirement. Yeah. I work half as much as I used to, and I enjoy what I do now. And I think it's really very personal to people what retirement means. And I think some of the people would read your book and say, I don't maybe want to go to that extreme, as you call it. But I think they can learn a lot from, well, what do you want?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't write a book with the it's not the kind of book of I did it and so can you by, you know, copying whatever I did. It's much more of a how to think about retirement and financial concepts in general. Essentially, how to run your personal and family life. So it's very much a manual to manuals or a design manual where people are, supposed to take the different parts and put them together in an optimal way to design a system that works very well. And if you have essentially a system that's designed well, it generally means that it runs very efficiently, and in that sense you get a lot more out of it compared to an inefficient design. And that's like one thing that has allowed me to kind of not need to have a job anymore.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting you use the word design. When I talked about your book the first time in the air, I mentioned that I believe that you must be a student of permaculture. Because you hadn't said the word, and you hadn't talked about growing anything in the book yet. It was just about lifestyle and the way to put it together. And I saw that correlation very, very clearly. And it makes me think of your book like a permaculture book for lifestyles, because like if I take the design manual from Bill Mollison, it doesn't tell me to plant, you know, parsley and borage together. It tells me this is how you design a system, and you put whatever you want into it based on where you're at, what you want to get out of it, et cetera. And I kind of see your book and your whole modus operandi that way. That's what you're telling people. These are all the inputs and the outputs. You stick this in, you get this out. So now you take that knowledge and actually do something with it, with a plan of a means to an end versus just kind of fumbling through it as you go.
Right. Yeah. It's on the strategic level, not the tactical level, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So that also means that it kind of requires you to have a tactical understanding. So you need to know, you know, how to make a budget and how to, I don't know, fry an egg. So basic things, you need to know that first, and then you can start designing. I would say in terms of permaculture, I actually read the Bill Mollison's design manual about the time I kind of got into this whole thing, around 2001. And most of it kind of just went over my head, I must admit, because I didn't have any gardening experience at all. So, but presume that you already have gardening experience, and then you read the design manual, you can start thinking about the bigger picture of how to do things. And my book is sort of like this, the design manual of personal finance, if that makes sense. And the concepts of design are very much similar from field to field. It's not like permaculture in the sense is at the peak of design thinking, and everything else follows from that. It's a very much more general way of systems thinking, and permaculture is like one thing, personal finance is another thing, and if you go into business, you have like operations management, which is also a form of systems thinking. You have huge economic models which are also based on a systems thinking approach, and you have management stuff like the fifth principle. It's all a form of applied systems thinking.
Sure. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, there was one word in there that tipped me off to the whole inner relationship, and it was you mentioned something like about society reaching a climax stage. And I think that's what, like, that one word, like was, like, tripped my radar. And what do you mean by that? Like, this, like, climate? Because I think I know, but I want to be sure.
All right. So a climax state is a permanent and stable plateau you reach in pretty much any evolving system. So you have it in nature, for instance, where you start with barren rock, and then after one point, you have the first population, which is something like moss and lichen, which is then followed by weeds, which feed off the first generation. And the weeds kind of evolve. You start having fir trees, which are then followed by more mature trees, and that they feed on and kill the previous systems. And as you go on, you make a more and more complex system, much more resilient system than the first one, and the eventual system will end up being very efficient in a sense. You see the same way, same thing in urban planning, where you start with, you know, farmland, then you build out a few streets into the farmland, you put up, you know, developments like suburbia, which have, you know, just cheap houses that are quick to build. Then you start putting in shops. Like, hopefully you'll start putting in shops and you'll eventually tear down the houses and build high-rise buildings, and then you'll develop into a full-fledged city. You will have the same thing in the generational approach I just spoke of. So with one generation starting from nothing, and then the next one managing what the first one builds, the next one working for the managers of the previous one, the fourth generation will then kind of not even have access to labor, and then everything crashes again. And then you restart over building a new society.
Yeah,
I could go on. Yeah, I mean,
that's kind of what really hit me when I read that is climax it defined is a plateau, and there's only one place to go next, and that's into a systemic collapse and then a rebuilding. And nature does this over thousands of years, many thousands of years, but we do it over a few generations. And that's why I do my show, and I think that's why the frugality that you bring to the table is so important, because I think that's where we're at. We're in this complex system that seems to have tremendous resiliency, but it's also sort of run its course, and it's time for a new cycle to begin. And that puts a lot of us that are in our age bracket in a really tough place. We don't get the fruits of the labor, so to speak, because the Social Security is not going to be there. And we're not getting to build highways or manage the highway systems. I thought that was hugely insightful when you mentioned that, like, the G.I. Joes, the World War II generation, basically came home and built the infrastructure, and the boomers came up being taught how to manage the infrastructure. And that didn't leave a lot of room when the boomers were still around for Gen X to do anything. And if it wasn't for the computers and internet, I don't know if they'd have anything to do at all.
Right, yeah. I mean, we're essentially right now in like, the winter stage of the Kondratiev cycle, right? Economically speaking, so that's the economy as a whole also follows that cycle. So, from a personal perspective, a personal finance perspective, I mean, my road has almost been like, well, you know, you can't do it like they do, so you have to do exactly what they do, but you have to do it really quick. You have to get your retirement money faster than the boomers are managing to accumulate there, so at least you won't go down with Generation X, you'll go down with the boomers instead, right?
Yeah, I got what you're saying there. So, I mean, one of the things that we can do to make that happen is you can only make so much money come in, and one of the big things we have to focus on is how much money goes out, and we call that savings. It's a word that's actually coming back in vogue now. Savings was like laughed at in the 90s, but people are actually seeing that maybe this is important now. So what kind of steps can a person take to start saving more?
Yeah, I would say, I don't think we're quite there yet. Definitely with the recession or depression or whatever you want to call it, double dip, it's been more, how do you say, popular. That's probably not the right word, but saving is not something that you scoff at anymore, but the usual the previous recommendation was always, well, you shouldn't waste your time saving money. You should spend your time trying to earn more money, you know, start a second business and so on and so forth. What I realized is probably somewhat to do with the career I was in, where salaries and so on were pretty fixed and non-negotiable and so on. But if you're kind of in that middle zone where I would say you earn somewhere between, say, 15,000, 150,000, there's not a whole lot you can do with your income compared to someone who earns, say, if you earn more than 150,000, a lot of your income is probably bonuses, and you're pretty close to the money stream, so you can have a large impact on your income if you put your focus there. If you're under 15,000, you might not have realized all of your potential. So focusing on your income, you can also bring yourself up. But if you're right in the middle, there's much less, how do you say, the return on effort of trying to increase your spending is not nearly as large as your return on effort trying to decrease your spending. And what you really want to look at is the ratio, namely your savings rate. And what people have typically been taught to save, especially with the way things have run previously, is like you're told to either, you know, get your 6% 401k match or save 10 to 15% for retirement, and then after 40 years with 40 hours a week, you can spend your money to replicate your previous income. So one of the things I looked at those equations, and then and they have certain presumptions. You know, you put in your savings rate of 10 to 15%, and then you put in your growth rate of the economy, and these guys are typically like wildly optimistic. You know, like they presume that the 10% rise you had from essentially the G.I. Joe generation and up until now will continue for the next, you know, that basically the next 60 years on the markets will be like the previous 60 years, which I don't believe in.
Sure, yeah, they promise average return on good quality mutual
funds. Right, yeah.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12%. And we can make you safer by assuming 8 and seeing what you really need to put in. And if Jane, exactly. John, if you put in X for this long, you'll get Y at the end and you can go to Disneyland. Or
exactly,
whatever.
Yeah. So what if you take those exact same equations and say, okay, what if I save 30% instead? You know, what does that do to my retirement age? And then you find, okay, if you save 30%, you could probably retire at some point in your like early 50s, mid 50s, like 55. And that's what, you know, the boomer generation calls early retirement. If you increase it to 50%, by decreasing essentially your spending by 50%, which is not a hard thing to do. I mean, we can get into that later. Then you move your retirement age down to the 40 year range, like 40 to 45, something like that. So what I did was to start saving 85%, and that was of an income of about 25,000. And with those numbers, you essentially reach a point where you spend less, obviously, because you're saving more and you haven't done anything about your income. But the ratio then tells you that you'll get to a point where you can, for the rest of your life, have all your expenses paid by investment income at a withdrawal rate, which is essentially a required return of investment of 3%, corrected for inflation. So 3% plus inflation gives you money for the rest of the life. For the rest of your life, if you save 85% in 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
assuming you're keeping the spend where it was to get there in the first place, but
exactly. Yeah. I mean, you have to take into account things like your health insurance will probably go up as you age.
Sure.
Obviously, so you pick the highest point and then you kind of plug that back into the equation. So I'm spending less now than I will be in like 30 years, right?
But your concept of saving is like build the dam higher, right? I mean, so that you keep more of what comes in. And you think about it, like if we have like a little tiny stream, there's a little trickle coming down the mountain, and we put in a dam, it can relatively quickly turn into a very large pond. And yeah. It makes me think of the one water dam up where I grew up in Pennsylvania where they had the overflow of the dam. And I can't remember the exact number, but basically this overflow was like a flat concrete sill. And they would take a 2x10, and it would fit in this slot, and they would add that 2x10 to the top of the sill. And it's just a board, you know?
Yeah.
And it was some ungodly number of, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons that would additionally be held back by sticking this one 10-inch piece of wood on top of the sill. And so it really shows what a small amount in can do if we save it up over time.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, I would also say that with I mean, that's as far as I understand, kind of like the compound thinking.
Sure.
If you wait enough time, then $1 turns into like $5. So if you save, you know, I don't know, $1 a day for a long time, it'll turn into way more than you thought it would. But if you only have 5 years to do it, compound interest is actually not doing very much for you, because there's just not very many years to compound for you.
So you have to stop the outflow.
You have to stop the outflow. That's good. That's a good way to put it. And I would also say, from like a the way to stop the outflow is to look at the Pareto principle. Typical frugality, how to save money advice, tends to focus on all the little things. You know, take showers, which are, you know, 5 minutes short, and you'll save this much water over the next 20 years or whatever. Use less toilet paper. I don't know, make your shoelaces last long. You know, there are also like thousands of tips of little things you can do, but to me that's just way too much effort to think about all these things. It's much better, I would say, to realize that your budget probably follows some kind of power law, which is, and the Pareto principle is a special case of a power law. It essentially says that it's like the 80-20 principle that says that like 20% of your budget entries probably account for 80% of your expenses. And the rest of the other 80% of your expenses only comprises 20% of your total budget. So that's kind of like the long tail. So if you look at a very typical budget, you say, how much do I spend on housing? Well, most people spend like 30% on housing. That's what they're told to
correct.
Do, right? And if you go into like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have this average American family, you know, and they give you very detailed what the average it's the average American family unit. It's 2.1 people, and it gives you all these numbers what they spend on, and if you look at those, you get about 30% for housing, 20% for transportation. That's gasoline, car payments, insurance, about 10% for food, something like that.
Okay,
so if you add
food, transport, and housing, we're at 60%.
Right. 60%, yeah. I mean, that means you're pretty much already there if you can reduce those 60% through some kind of clever design, right? So the first thing you can do is look at transportation. I think that's the easiest thing to deal with, which means when you look at where you live, most people, or many people, will live somewhere out in the suburbs, and they'll spend every day, you know, commuting 1 or 2 hours. So I would say to reduce transportation, what I usually do is I looked at where I worked, and then I went into Google Maps, or you can get a city map, and then you kind of print out, you take, you know, a pin, and you take a piece of thread, a line, and then you draw a 2 or 3 mile radius. That's the area where you should be living inside of. And then you find a place where you're within 3 miles of your work, and you're also within 3 miles of shopping. And if you do that, you can get rid of at least your own car compared to that work. If you have like a two income family, well, maybe the other one needs a car, but you can ditch one car. You can save 20% more now, which for people, you know, who used to be saving 10 to 15% will put them now in the 30 to 35% range, which again will give them their financial independence at age 55. Then there's some design principles about that. Okay, so instead of driving your car, you're now riding your bike, or you're walking, or at the worst, you're taking public transportation. Well, that kind of means that you can cut your gym membership out, because now you're getting free exercise. That gives you a little extra boost. So that kind of, we can talk about later. I kind of call it a web of design goals, where you try to accomplish several goals at the same time with only one action, and you kind of try to weave them together into a web.
That's a very survival oriented principle, even like wilderness survival. If I go into the woods, I'm going to carry a knife, obviously, but I want to carry a knife that can function as a hatchet, do intricate work, function for building other things. So I want a multifunctional thing. So you're saying same type of thing. I want to take an action that has a multifaceted response to it, a multifaceted effect.
Exactly, because then it means that you only need to spend money on that one thing, and that one thing might even be free in terms of, you know, like walking to work. I did that for, how long was that? Half a year. I walked 10 kilometers a day, so what is that, like 8 miles, 7-8 miles a day back and forth. And that's kind of like a very meditative and relaxing thing to do, and you get really good at walking. I mean, it's all about, you know, how often do you do it? I mean, there's a whole range of what people say is a hard thing to do, like running 5 kilometers. You know, if you're like a couch potato, that's a really hard thing to do. You know, it's probably, running is all about, you know, perspiration and sweating and side stitches and being out of breath. Whereas if you go to like an athlete, you know, 5 kilometers, well, sure, you know, I don't even need to put my joggers on, I'll just run it, right? So that's with the transportation. Now, when you're already looking at where to live. The next thing to look at is your housing, your 30% outgoing budget entry. And a lot of people have been told, yeah, you should buy as much house as you possibly can, right? And what happens with housing is the way we kind of think about products. It's gotten to be a point, and that kind of became somewhat obvious to me when I came over from, I actually went to grad school in Switzerland, but it's kind of like the European philosophy in terms of consumerism is probably lagging that of the US by about 10, 15 years. Consumerism, you very much have this philosophy that everything becomes a product. So if you have a problem, you go out and buy a solution. So my first example for that was when I met my wife and girlfriend back then. They wanted to do a barbecue, but they didn't have any way of heating the meat, so the vegetables. So in what I was used to, okay, you don't have a propane grill, a brick coal grill. So what I would have done is you go gather some rocks, and then you would go into your oven and pull out one of the plates, and then you just kind of like spread the coals on the ground. You light them, you put the grate you already have, and then you're barbecuing. But they immediately, say, oh, let's start drive over to Walmart and buy a propane grill, some propane, then drive back again. So instead of thinking about improvising a solution, you go out and buy a solution. The problem with that is if you kind of repeat that for all the problems you have, you end up with a whole lot of stuff. And you just kind of tend to accumulate stuff and stuff and stuff, and after a while your house kind of gets full of all sorts of things, and you think, okay, this feels cramped in here, I need to move, this house is no longer big enough for me, I need to get into a bigger house. And then you start the process all over. I mean, I live in California now, and if it's a really sunny day, people will typically open their garages, and you can see that their garage is kind of like acts as an overflow reservoir for the stuff from the rest of the house. It's like nobody here parks their car in their garages because they're full of crap, essentially. So if you kind of get out of that idea of buying products, then you can live in a smaller place because you don't need extra bedrooms, which you're not in anyway because they're full of things. And then you save money on the stuff, you save money on the housing, you save money on transportation because you live closer. So say you can cut your housing down from 30% to maybe 10% of your outgoing. So that's 20% more, so that's 40%. So now you're up on the 50% range, right? Which means you pushed retirement down to age financial independence, as I like to think of it, down to age 40.
And I'm gonna ask a question to the audience out there right now, and we're all supposed to be survivalists. How many of you have ever actually thought, hey, I could pull the grate out of my oven and turn that into something to cook on with a few rocks and some wood in my backyard? And I bet most of you have not. And it's interesting how these two worlds overlap, because what Jacob is talking about is improvising and adapting in a current system where it's not required that you do so. And what we're always talking about is being prepared to adapt if we need to do so. And the best way to be prepared to do without is to learn how to do without today when we don't have to. We can do it by choice versus tomorrow when we have to do it by, let's just call it no choice.
I utterly agree with that statement. It's actually something I had on my short list of things I had to make sure to say, in a sense. But is this whole lip below you? I mean, survival to me is very much about living with less means, right?
Absolutely.
And living below your means is a very good practice for living with less means. And I actually got into this whole thing back in, it was kind of, it was a run together of several different factors, which happened late 2001 for me. I just had a computer with the internet installed in my room. That's always a bad combination for someone who reads a lot. So I discovered the concept of peak oil. The fact that oil production is gonna eventually peak and then start a slow decline of about 3% a year. There was a lot of disagreement on the exact rate of decline, and people, some thought that, okay, it's going to be a slow decline that's going to last decades. Others thought, you know, okay, gas prices are going to shoot up to $10 and everybody's going to start to kill each other. And so previous to that, my kind of like idea of the future was very much like what you see in Star Trek. You know, we're gonna invent transporter technology and replicators and starships and whatever. So that's kind of like my idea of the future at the point. And then I kind of got my eyes opened, like, oh shit, this could go really bad. You know, and I'm not prepared at all for this. And I was reading all these, you know, survival books and so on, how to, you know, like skin a rabbit and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And at the same time, I was fairly limited in what I could do because I was living in a one room dorm in the pretty much 10 minutes away from my from where I worked, and it was kind of hard to move out in the country. Anyway, so what I did was so combine this with the fact that at the same time I started learning about the financial system and how things like mortgages and interests work and how federal, you know, how reserve banking was working. And then I kind of realized, hey, man, if I go get a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage, you know, I'm going to get screwed over, essentially, because that's how they work. You know, they pump the price. I mean, if you give like, low interest rates to people, if you make low interest rates widely available, you're essentially financializing an object. And this has been done since the 60s. What has successfully been financialized is pretty much cars and houses. And as a result, the prices for those have gone way up. And that essentially if you look at a typical mortgage, you'll be paying for your house not once but twice over. And I'm like too tightwadish to accept paying twice the price for the house just because I haven't saved my money. So I started saving my money for a house initially. And then at the same time, I started kind of like prepping for the peak oil thing. So now I kind of forget where I was going with this. So, but maybe you have a question.
No, I mean, I think that's actually fascinating. And that is something that, you know, we can all look at and see that, you know, history and the future, the perceived future, short term, are showing to be absolutely true. We have seen the housing market crash, and it's a direct result of people no longer looked at the house as costing $250,000. And like you're saying, the real cost of that $250,000 house is more like a half a million to three quarters of a million, depending on the interest rate. They looked at it as costing $1,500 a month or $2,000 a month or what have you, plus taxes on it and everything else. So the house wasn't really being sold on its price, but on its payment. And because of that, whatever you could afford is what you would buy. And it would, if you got bigger and better, so be it. And how anybody didn't see this coming, I don't understand, because there can only be one result if you do that long enough. The real value has to start to show underneath. Eventually, as soon as all people start to lose jobs and whatever, it's not that your house lost 30% of its value. It's it was 30% overvalued, and taking away the false money showed the underlying value for what it was.
Exactly, yeah. And right now we have this problem. That's essentially a financial problem. And in the U.S. we have essentially, I would say, the problem that Japan had with its real estate bubbles, where they had and probably still have, in a sense, all kind of business, the big blue chips in Japan, the blue chip companies were essentially so interlocked that none of them could be allowed to fail. And over here we're kind of repeating that with the housing markets. We're just not allowing houses to go down to what they should actually be valued at. But a bigger problem is that, okay, I mean, the financial system in itself is just a social construct. If you could kind of get everybody to agree on completely revamping the system tomorrow, it could in principle be done. I mean, sure, obviously there would be a lot of screaming and so on, right? But it could be done. I mean, a much bigger problem is the lack of like oil depletion. I mean, you can't go out to an oil well and say, give me more oil. You know, I'm willing to write a big check. You know, it's like, you know, the oil is not going to come out of the ground if it's not there just because you're waving around a big check.
Yeah, it makes me think of the old saying, you know, you can't get blood from a stone.
Yeah.
And the reality is you can't get oil from a stone once it's given you all the oil it's got, too. I mean, and we can all debate on how long it's going to take for peak oil to hit and what the decline rate is, et cetera. But what we do know is from a long-term bell curve to an abrupt drop, neither one of them is very good. Both of them suck, and both of them get worse over time.
Yeah, I mean it's in my perspective. I mean I kind of started out as a fast crash kind of person, but I've kind of come to the belief that a decline in energy resources can be so slow that most people probably won't notice it. I mean it's not like it's public knowledge that oil production peaked in 2005. I don't think that's public knowledge.
It should be, but it isn't. It's not public knowledge that the chief geologist for the Saudi Arabian government sent a communication to our Department of Energy that said, you know how we said we can up production anytime we want to? Yeah, we didn't really mean that. We're just saying that. And that came out, of course, in the WikiLeaks thing. Then everybody wanted to, you know, string up this army private, Julian Assange over. But that's like one of the, like, it's like society doesn't want to know because that's out there. And this isn't some conspiracy theorist on Coast to Coast AM or something. The head of the Department of Geology for Saudi Arabia's government says, we're there. Right. This is what we can do. And it's only going down from here. And no one seems to either want to know or actually know that stuff like this is going on.
Exactly. I mean, it kind of got public attention around 2007-08 when prices were going up to like $150 a barrel. And then they went down again and people kind of forgot about it. But
oh, that peak, we did that already. Yeah. It's over. Like, it's the same thing with the natural disasters. There's an earthquake in Haiti. I wrote a check to the Red Cross like 6 months. They can't still be dealing with that, can they? That's just the mentality that we're in today. So I kind of want to move toward, you know, the completion of this is what's the solution for people? If you had, for the person out there saying, okay, I'm with the preparedness mindset, I'm with the frugality mindset, but the numbers just don't work for me. We've talked about transportation and where you live. Are there other ways people can look at, you know, stopping the outflow, so to speak?
Well, so I also mentioned the idea of getting away from the product mentality, the consumerism mentality, of trying to, whenever you have a problem, go out and buy something. It's kind of I've heard you say on your podcast from time to time, like if you have a gun, you don't have ammo, you just have essentially like a heavy block of metal, right?
And you got a very expensive club.
Exactly, yeah. if you have the gun and you have the ammo, but you don't know how to shoot it, it's not a huge difference from having a block, from having a club of metal.
Correct.
So if you look at the, how do you say, if we stay in the analogy, if you look at the weapon system, it kind of starts with, it kind of goes from the ammo, the bullet that eventually hits the target to the gun, to the person who's shooting the gun. So that's your complete weapon system. So if you take that kind of progression, the idea is that you move as much as you can into the person, if that makes sense. Like, it doesn't make sense for the gun because you can't really shoot a bullet out of your finger, right? But if you look at the barbecuing scenario, thinking about just picking up a few rocks from the garden, forming them in a circle, and then going into your oven after for the grate, then you kind of move the idea of barbecuing into your head and away from your $100 propane grill, right? So the more you can move, I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, the more you know, the less you need, right?
So correct. Focus on the operator over the equipment.
Exactly. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I mean, it's much easier to sell to people on, like, well, you don't have to think. You just buy a product. I think it's kind of like a general sentiment that many people don't like to think.
Sure.
It sounds a little harsh, but I think that's kind of like the reality of things.
I think it's one of the unintended consequences, and I'm a capitalist, so I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way, but it's one of the unintended consequences of capitalism, is that there's a lot of people out there that develop a product not because there is a need for it, but because they think somebody will buy it. The only reason it's like, can I position this product in a way that people will consume it whether they need it or not. If we think about the entire process of a grill, even what you said, pulling the grate out of the oven, cooking food over fire predates man's understanding of how to bend metal in the first place. So for a long time, society was able to burn meat over coals with no grill, not even the one out of the oven.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could just take like a wooden stick or something and put it on
sure.
that and just pull it over the fire. I don't know if I'll blame... I mean, I think a bigger problem that causes this line of thinking is the problem of specialization. In the sense that now everybody's kind of like trained to be essentially like a replaceable cog in the big business machine.
Correct.
Which means that okay, you're told you become a better specialist, so we'll pay you more. And this all happens at the expense of knowing anything else about anything, almost. I mean, I've seen people being very impressed with themselves the first time they learned to fry an egg, and I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? You know, but no, that's serious. They never learned to fry an egg, you know. And I mean, we can kind of go back to kind of like if you look at the three big expenses, you know, housing, transportation. The third one is food.
Sure.
And out of food, half of it is spent on eating out. And a lot of that happens because people simply don't know how to cook well enough to enjoy their own cooking. So there's definitely like several thousand dollars worth of recovery there by learning how to cook. And that's also kind of like, in a sense, good preparation for a long slide. Because I'm mostly a bean and rice guy. I don't know if that makes any. That's probably not that important. That comes out of historically being a vegetarian for a long time. I eat a little meat now, but not a lot. But those two things are like, they cost almost nothing to prepare. And it's all about, you know, if you just take some beans and cook those and take some rice and cook those and you smash them together and put ketchup over them, that's terrible, right? most of that stuff is in exactly how long do you cook the beans, you know, that makes a huge difference. Most people don't know that. It takes like a little, you need to kind of develop a knack for it, if that makes sense. And then you need to learn how to use spices properly. Again, you kind of take an approach to cooking that is more in a sense of understanding cooking than following a recipe.
Absolutely. And we've had quite a few chefs on that have said just that. And kind of backing up a little bit, though, when you were talking about the specialization and the problem with it, here's what I was thinking when I was reading your book and you were talking about how specialized people become, and they become like, you know, like a cog. And if the engineer shoots himself, quits, or gets hired by somebody else, you just stick another one in there and the machine keeps running. And for all the value that we place in a college education and being highly specialized, if I take two businesses, and one's a ranch, right, and one is a computer design firm, and in the computer design firm, a highly specialized manufacturing engineer dies, I can put his resume out on a job board like Monster, and in a day have 80 people with his qualifications. I can give them the basic overview of the business and stick them back in there, right? Now, the ranch hand, right, that if something happens to him, and he's like my key guy on the ranch that takes care of mending my fences, does veterinary work that's not where I need to call the vet in, knows the trees, knows the land, knows the cattle, knows all that stuff, but never even graduated high school. If he dies, I've got a problem, right? And we in society would look at the ranch hand and say he's far less educated than the specialist, but the specialist is, what's the word I'm looking for, modular, right?
Right,
I can pop him out and pop somebody in just like him. And, yeah, there's guys that are at the very top level, but I only need a few of those. And I can have a massive company of 5,000 of these guys. I can move around on any given day. The company keeps going. But that one, undereducated ranch hand, it might take me years to find someone that has his level of knowledge and breadth of knowledge. And that guy's probably doing he's probably doing it for somebody else. It's actually a lot harder to replace that jack of all trades than it is to replace that highly specialized person.
And in a sense, it's but I would say then it's just as easy to become a jack of all trades as it is to become the specialized person. So if you spend like three,
I think it's easier. The question then, Jacob, is why do so many people choose to become the specialized, easily replaceable person instead of this multifunctional, you call it the modern Renaissance man? Why don't people choose that anymore?
It's very hard to, give a reason. I mean, from the perspective of the system, so to speak, the system that makes up all our traditions and cultures and how we do things. It's much more efficient for the system to have a modular build-up with easily replaceable cogs than it would be to have to. It's kind of like if you have to build a car, right? If you had to learn to do all the things you need to do to build a car on your own, machining, casting, how to make rubber, how to even mine the metals. I mean, there's some examples of a few people who have actually done that, and it takes them about 2 decades to build a car. And if you took like 200 people, you know, and had each of them build their own car and learn everything they needed to do, said 200 people, right? Then after 2 decades, you'd have 200 cars. Whereas instead, if you made some kind of if you went with the specialized approach, and you teach person A to press this button, person 2 to press another button, and, you know, weld a little here and so on and so forth, they can produce far more than 200 cars over 2 decades. So from the perspective of the system, that's the best way to do it. But what I think is that in their personal lives, people have gone a little bit overboard in that kind of thinking. You know, because the frequent argument is like, well, I'm a lawyer, I make $200 an hour, so why should I cook my own food, right? But...
Well, and even if you don't every night, at least you should know how. That's why for a lawyer, you can't make a freaking egg, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
Like, I look back to, like, the G.I. Joe generation, right? That's the, you call it, the guys that came home from World War II that fought the war. I think of, like, my grandfather. And he had a job, right? He was a carpenter. And that's what he did. And if you wanted him to frame something, he could frame it and what have you. And that was what he went off and did for his, to earn his bread every day. But if we were out on the river with the boat and the motor would start, give the guy a flathead screwdriver, one tool, and he's going to get the motor to run to get you at least back to shore. If something went wrong at the house with the garden, he could figure it out. Like, they kind of worked. That generation to me did both sides of things. Like, they had this multi-depth Renaissance lifestyle on the personal life, and then they had their skill set. But yet, even like a carpenter, right? So if, like, when he got laid off from being a carpenter, he could go work for a cabinet manufacturer, or he could go, he could basically do just about anything in the construction world as a carpenter. So even his profession was multidisciplined. Where now, if you are a guy that works on a specific type of programming language for a specific system that the U.S. military uses, you might have to go all the way back to ground zero from a study standpoint to get another skill set if that system stops being used.
My response to that is, Duma side, the problem is that we often hire and we have no choice but to hire an expert even if we want to do simple things. Like, say your toilet gets clogged or something like that. And then you need to call in a plumber and he'll be charging, you know, I don't know, $150 an hour or something. But for something that's really, I mean, because you're essentially buying his combined expertise to do a very simple job that you could easily learn to do yourself, you know. And same thing, you know, with car repairs. A lot of them are, in a sense, simple, like an oil change or something. If you take your bicycle to a bicycle mechanic around here and you say, well, I want a tune-up, I want a complete tune-up, he'll charge you $200 for that, for what is essentially tightening a few nuts with a few specialized tools. So what we've kind of lost with all this excess, in my opinion, it's inappropriate specialization, is that we have lost the basic knowledge of I would say almost everything. I don't know if that's kind of like hyperbole, but all the little things that takes maybe, I don't know, you know, a few hours to figure out how to fix yourself, like, you know, like a broken washing machine. What can go wrong with a washing machine? Well, it's probably the engine. Either it's the engine or it's the belt. And you can check either, you know, you open it up and you see what's wrong, you order the replacement part. Instead of hiring your $100+ an hour expert to come in and fix it for you. And by kind of taking the attitude, well, instead of, you know, picking up the phone and calling in an expert, I'm gonna try to do this myself. And in a great deal of cases, you kind of realize, well, this is actually pretty simple. I don't need to pay for an expert to come in. The problem with the system, and essentially, is that we've kind of like divided everybody into experts in their little field and non-experts in everything else. Like there's very little generalized knowledge, and how do you say, a typical person. The ideal is that we know everything about nothing and nothing about everything.
Yeah, I completely agree with that as well. I guess like you talk a lot about like kind of the modern Renaissance type of lifestyle. I'd like to talk a little bit about that. What you mean by that, and what do you do with your time? You know, I mean, you're in your mid 30s and you're, you know, retired in your view and in my view. But in your notes over to me, you're like, I don't take cruises in Spanish lessons, and I kind of see a little shot across the pond in Paris there, right?
Yeah.
But so what do you think is like a valuable way for you to spend your time now? What do you do with your freedom?
Well, in one sense, I mean, some of the stuff I do is similar to what you're doing for personal finance. I mean, I have my blog. It has about 250,000 page views per month now. I have a very active forum and so on. But as you said, I mean, you spend however many hours a day on this. For you, like a couple of hours a day. For me, it's probably even less than that. I do a lot of things that kind of like I like to learn skills, new skills. That kind of fascinates me. Kind of like how some people might be fascinated by traveling to a new place. I'm fascinated by learning a new skill. So right now, I'm learning essentially cabinet making or woodworking. I've learned how to fix bikes pretty much up to the point of starting from a, up to the point of not being able to build my own frame. But if you give me a frame, I can put a bike together for you. I've learned how to sail. I mean, we're talking about 3 years here, so I've learned how to sail. I typically last year I spent about every week one race weekly on a 35-foot sailboat as a crew, and we did pretty well there. What else? I train martial arts 3 times a week. But I do lots of different things, and I kind of do them. I like to say I do whatever I want, whenever I want, within reason.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just to put it in perspective for people, what kind of an annual budget do you have to maintain that type of lifestyle? How much does it cost to fund that?
I spend $6,000 a year, or $12,000 for the two of us, me and my wife, and then I spend $1,000 on martial arts training, so $7,000 for one person.
So, you and your wife together, you're at like $13,000 there.
Yep. Well, she spends a little on her stuff too, so maybe 14.
But I mean, I think if you called it 20, most Americans don't live that diverse and fulfilling of a life. And a lot of Americans are out there, you know, making 80, 90, 100,000 a year in a family of two, coming away at the end of the year with very little left, and they don't have anywhere near that quality of life. What really makes the difference for you?
It's the transportation. It's all the things we kind of discussed here. It's like we live right now. We live in an RV, and a lot of people say, "Oh, you live in an RV. I don't want to do that." But I mean, I've kind of computed the cost for living here, and it would correspond to having a house of with a value of about 100,000. So we just live in, but say if you had your $100,000 house, our equivalent, and you owned it outright, you'd already be saving half its price in interest. So that's kind of like the fourth big category after housing, transportation, food. The next one is interest payments and fees. So sure. Naturally, we don't pay any of those. But otherwise, it's living close to your work, so you need much less transportation, not buying stuff all the time, doing a lot of your own cooking, not paying for services or for things, services you could easily do yourself if you just knew how. So these are kind of the basic things, I would say. The interesting part is that people have kind of been trained to just look at the budget. So, you know, like we live under the official poverty line, which is really weird. But what the poverty line doesn't really take into account is the efficiency with which you spend your money, right? So you basically have, you know, like you take how much you spend, and then you kind of you ought to multiply that with an efficiency factor, and then you get your quality of lifestyle. But most people don't consider the fact that some people can, say, spend their money 50% more efficient than they can, 100%, 200% more efficient. So if we compare our budget to the budget of our neighbors, I mean, I bet they spend four times as much as we do, and they live in pretty much the same way. So, I mean, it's all about kind of like optimizing things, making things fit together, make sure that whenever you engage in some activity that it's beneficial in like three different other ways. So everything kind of ties together, you know. If you don't buy stuff, you don't spend as much money, and at the same time you don't need as big as a house. It all kind of comes back to this way of designing your lifestyle for maximum resilience and efficiency.
Absolutely. And I mean, you talk about this stuff every day on your blog, right? Where can people find out more information about your book, your blog? What's your website address?
The website address is earlyretirementextreme.com. And the title of the book is the same for historical reasons. There's a forum. There's a link on the blog to the forum. I would say a lot of the action these days is on the forum, because I must admit I don't blog a whole lot about it anymore, because I think I kind of feel that everything that needs to be said has already been said, and I don't like repeating myself a whole lot. So a lot of the blog posts are essentially reruns. We recently started developing a Wikipedia for various tips and tricks on how to save money.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
We'll have to have people check that out.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems is kind of like the same problem I had when I first read Bill Mollison's design manuals. Like, you know, well, the concepts, I get them, but I have no idea how to implement them.
Sure.
Because
sure.
To me, gardening was throwing seeds in the ground, you know, and I didn't even know what came up. And in the same way, a lot of it's kind of like high concept level stuff. So if you don't know the basics, it's much harder to understand. You know, pedagogically speaking, people would often like to have an example instead of saying, "Well, this is that stretch." You know, you just, you know, put it together with what you already know. But if you don't know it, then you can't put two together, right? So that's why we started on the Wikipedia.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I think it's going to be definitely a place folks are going to want to check out. Again, the website, earlyretirementextreme.com, and the book, Early Retirement Extreme, available on Amazon. I think that's where I got it. I got it on Kindle. You can get a hard copy as well, folks. Can't recommend the book highly enough. I think it'll change the way you think about things. And being from a physicist, it's got a lot of diagrams and things like that that change the words into thought pictures and help you really gain a grasp of things. So, Jacob, man, thanks for being with us today on the Survival Podcast.
Well, thank you for letting me come on to your show.
Well, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up.
I hope you know some of this stuff is kind of high level conceptual thinking, but if you really listen to today's show in depth, I think you'll realize that it really just comes down to a choice and what we want and how much of that we're willing, you know, to work for. I also think that one of the things that we really need to take away from this is you've got a man and his wife living below what the federal government would call the poverty level, but living a much higher quality of life than most people in America currently are, making four or five times the amount of money. And we need to learn from that, because what I've been talking about recently with downward class migration is coming. It absolutely is. There's no way around it. The financial system's broken. And as Jacob said today, yes, we could fix it if we would all get into agreement and do that, but I'm not betting on it happening. And I don't think you should either. So learning to do less with more now is a great way to be able to continue to do that when there actually is less. So please be thinking about that. Check out Jacob's website again, earlyretirementextreme.com, and the book by the same name. And with that, this has been Jack Spirko today, along with Jacob Lund Fisker, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast, Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com, anytime you shop online. And while you'll support us, no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouch for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.